Good morning, this is AM, I'm Chris Yuleman. Pope Francis is reforming the Vatican's Curia, its notoriously secretive and Machiavellian bureaucracy, and Australia's Cardinal George Pell has been appointed head of a new secretariat for the economy to clean up the Vatican's scandal-plagued finances. Cardinal Pell will have oversight of all the financial and administrative activities of the Holy See. The move means he'll leave his current role as Archbishop of Sydney. Europe correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
It's considered the biggest shake-up of the Curia in years and comes in response to the corruption scandals which have plagued the Vatican's key financial institutions. A year into his papacy, Pope Francis has created a secretariat for the economy and named George Pell one of eight cardinals who have been advising him on reform as its head. Cardinal Pell will answer directly to Pope Francis in the new role. Robert Mickens is the Vatican correspondent for the Catholic Weekly, The Tablet.
I'd say this is quite a plan. Posting. I mean, it's a brand new position that's been created. It's a top-level Vatican post. In some ways, you might say he's the chancellor of the exchequer, in a sense, you know, from the Vatican's point of view. So he's going to play a key role in putting the finances of Vatican City and its expenditures in a more transparent and fiscally sound light, I would say.
But does he really have the financial credentials for the task?
That's a good question. I think together with establishing this secretariat for the economy, the Pope also has instituted a council for the economy, and that will be made up of 15 people, eight of whom are bishops or cardinals from around the world, and the other seven who are lay experts in finance. And the cardinal will be working with that group, which will be advising him. So it's not as if George Pell is going to take on the finances of the Vatican single-handedly.
What about dealing with the scandals that have beset the Vatican's finances so far? Will he be trying to deal with those in any way?
Yeah, I would use the phrase that's become very popular in the English language media, moving forward. At this point, I think Cardinal Pell's brief is in moving forward with the finances at the Vatican, more than looking backward at and trying to clean up the mess.
Tim Fisher is the former Australian ambassador to the Holy See.
He's fluent in Italian. He is driven by efficiency on all matters financial, and is a good lateral thinker. There's going to be winds of change driven through by this key appointment.
The Archdiocese of Sydney has released a statement confirming George Pell will leave his current role as Archbishop of Sydney to take up the new position. He's expected to relocate to the Vatican by the end of next month. This is Barbara Miller reporting for AM.
A week ago, Viktor Yanukovych was a head of state. Today, he's Ukraine's most wanted man, hunted for the mass murder of citizens during the violent demonstrations in Kiev. The Russian government has called his ouster an act of armed mutiny and recalled its ambassador in protest. Moscow fears that it's lost an ally to the new Western-leaning government. The ABC's Europe correspondent Philip Williams is in Kiev.
The Russian Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, said that the interim authorities in Kiev had conducted an armed mutiny. He said, in effect, there was no one to deal with there because he didn't recognise their authority. So relations are really hitting rock bottom. The Russian ambassador to Ukraine has been withdrawn, taken back to Moscow for consultation. That's always a bad sign. And despite the protestations of the new administration here in Kiev that everything's fine and that they can still have a good relationship with the Russians, it's certainly not working at Moscow's end.
And where is President Yanukovych?
That's a good question. Simply answered, we don't know. He's probably in Crimea. That's where he was last seen. That's in the south of the country. That's his heartland, really. That's where his support base is strongest. And that's where he's more likely to be sheltered. But he could be out of the country already. We don't know that if he's managed to smuggle himself across the border. We heard one story that he was stopped at a border over the weekend and not allowed to cross. But his whereabouts are unknown. But he's certainly wanted. He's now officially wanted. He's wanted for investigation into possible crimes associated with the murder of 88 people over the past week or so.
And some of Viktor Yanukovych's homes have been opened up, or properties, and you've been to see one. What was it like?
Yes, I went to his property just outside, his main house really, just outside of Kiev, and it's quite extraordinary. It looks from a very long distance like a large log cabin. When you get up close, it's a six-storey building. It's 140 hectares of land that he's taken. He's got a golf course, a zoo, multiple ponds, incredible gardens, massive garage filled with very expensive cars. And today they opened it up to everyone. So you had literally thousands of people absolutely gobsmacked at the opulence. And that contrasts so greatly with their lives, the average life of a Ukrainian who've really struggled because the economy's been struggling. And of course, so many expressions of absolute outrage and anger that this man could have spent so much money in a country that was really failing economically and dependent on handouts from the Russians and probably now the EU over the next few days just to survive. So if they do catch him, and they are certainly determined to do so, he'll face not only, I think, the charges over the killings, but also the wrath of the nation over the opulence and spending on his own, basically his own opulent environment.
The ABC's Europe correspondent, Philip Williams. And in another shock to the fragile nation of Egypt, its interim government has resigned. The government was installed after a popular uprising ousted the Islamist president. But overnight, the Prime Minister announced his cabinet's resignation and gave no reason for it. There is speculation that it paves the way for a presidential bid by the Defence Minister, Field Marshal Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Our Middle East correspondent is Hayden Cooper. Hayden, this move came as a complete surprise.
It did, Chris. It was announced by Prime Minister Beglawi on state television straight after a very short cabinet meeting, apparently. And strangely enough, he didn't really enunciate exactly why the cabinet had decided to stand down. Now, he alluded to some of the economic problems that the country is facing. For example, public sector strikes, which are ongoing at the moment. He said the government has made all efforts to get Egypt out of what he called a narrow tunnel, and that from a security aspect at least, he said that things have improved. But mysteriously, he went on to say that there are more issues behind the resignation, but it's best not to air them here at this moment. So that has led some to speculate that perhaps the resignation is more about the army chief, Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, and he's very likely run for president.
So is it likely that there'll be an announcement from General Sisi about that?
Look, we don't know for sure, but probably yes is the best guess. Field Marshal Sisi must resign as defence minister before he announces a run for president. So the move today is interpreted in some senses as a big show of support, really, from the entire cabinet and the entire government. So instead of Field Marshal Sisi resigning as defence minister on his own, the whole cabinet has stood down and, in a sense, really paved the way now for him to announce that he will run for president. But we've been waiting for this moment for a few months now and still there's nothing. I guess we'll just go on waiting.
And will it lead to any dramatic change in Egyptian policy, especially in relation to the crackdown on opponents like journalist Peter Greste?
Look, I doubt it. Sadly, remember that it's the military that's really in charge in Egypt, and I don't see any reason to expect any change of policy from them. Even if General Sisi does depart and run for president, it's likely that he'll be replaced in the role of defence minister by one of his close protégés. And furthermore, just look at the trajectory of this interim military-backed government. We've seen a severe crackdown on dissent, protesters, critics, academics, all put in jail. Even in the past 24 hours, two journalists have been referred to the military court for broadcasting a leaked conversation involving Field Marshal Sisi. So it very much looks like that pattern of suppression of dissent shows no signs at all of waning.
The ABC's Middle East correspondent, Hayden Cooper. And you're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 20 minutes past 7. And you can also follow us on Twitter. Just search AM World Today PM, and the audio and transcripts of our stories, as well as links to our Facebook page, can be found on our website. Just type AM space ABC into your search engine and follow the links. Some of the nation's top police officers have been grilled by politicians over last week's raid on Channel 7. Australian Federal Police officers told a Senate hearing they felt they had no choice but to carry out the operation in an attempt to get more information about the TV network's negotiations with convicted drug smuggler Schapelle Corby. Several senators repeatedly raised their concerns about the AFP's actions and an error it made on a document relating to the raid. But the Attorney-General, George Brandis, says he has no criticism of the police. From Canberra, James Glenday reports.
The case of convicted drug smuggler Schapelle Corby has captivated and concerned the nation. And late last night, the AFP's efforts to stop Ms. Corby selling her story captivated and concerned senators.
We understand this is a difficult issue for Channel 7, absolutely. Would they enjoy being having police officers turned up at their doorstep and issue a search warrant? Absolutely not, and I understand that.
During an estimates hearing, Police Chief Tony Negus and one of his deputies, Michael Phelan, faced a barrage of questions from Liberal Senator Helen Kroger about why they thought it necessary or appropriate to raid Channel 7 while it was in negotiations with the Corby family for an exclusive interview.
At the time, there was a lot of material around, even from Channel 7, around a deal being done.
As there was with Networks 10, as there was with Networks 9.
Well, those networks in particular didn't have one of their major presenters sitting in the same villa.
The officers argued Schapelle Corby's luxury villa was enough to give the impression a deal was close. They say Channel 7 was helpful during negotiations and at handing over information. But Commissioner Negus says his staff thought there were documents missing that they needed. His explanation for carrying out the raid clearly annoyed Independent Senator Nick Xenophon.
They went to a magistrate, they convinced a magistrate,
based on information on oath, because the search warrant suspected they were going to destroy documents. That's an outrageous assertion.
No, I made no such assertion. Well,
the AFP said it had to act quickly because in the past it had struggled to seize money paid to the Corby family for a book deal.
$250,000 went offshore and was lost to the jurisdiction.
The officers say they're still waiting to find out exactly what information is in the documents they seized, and insisted a mistake on a document related to the raid didn't affect the AFP's right to carry out the operation. Liberal Senator Bill Heffernan wanted to know why the officers were carrying weapons.
I mean, it's very confronting if you're a pregnant woman walking down the bloody aisle and here comes a copper with his gun hanging out.
The conduct of AFP officers is being investigated. Labor Senator Sam Dastyari asked the Attorney-General George Brandis what he thought.
In your opinion, did the AFP act appropriately?
I have no criticism to offer of the AFP. I have complete confidence in the AFP and I don't comment on operational matters.
The Attorney-General George Brandis ending that report from James Glenday. The Treasurer's campaign to make drastic structural changes to revive the government's finances has won the backing of the Business Council of Australia. Like Joe Hockey, the council wants the government to slash spending and map out a credible path back to budget surplus. In its budget submission, the powerful business lobby is urging a review of workplace relations laws and whether the retirement age needs to be lifted. It also wants worker entitlements such as penalties and leave loadings on the budget agenda. The council's chief executive Jennifer Westacott is speaking with our business editor Peter Ryan.
I think this is a sort of line in the sand budget. I'm not sure that it needs to be, you know, really, really tough in 1 year, but it does have to set a tough set of decisions over the medium term. It has to set out the structural reform that will involve some tough choices that government has to go down so that we can get our fiscal position under control.
Like the Treasurer Joe Hockey, you're pushing for structural change, and in your submission you refer to unsustainable growth in major spending programs. So should all options be on the table?
Absolutely, all options should be on the table, because we need to have a close examination of, well, where can we reduce the rate of growth? what will be the impact on the community, on individuals, and what will be the impact if we don't make those choices in 5 or 10 years' time when we have to make very severe cuts at a time when the population is ageing and potentially our revenue base is further eroding.
So the age pension and the retirement age, perhaps boosting that above the current 65, really needs to be seriously considered.
Well, we do need to consider these things, and we need to remember that you can make changes to these very big government outlays over a long period of time. We need to look at the whole issue of welfare and say, can we sustain welfare being, I guess, diluted across many people and many income brackets versus targeting to those in most need?
In the submission, you talk about wanting to reorient workplace laws. What do you mean by that?
Well, we've really got to take a cold, hard look at some of our workplace laws in respect of the way in which they're harming Australia's competitiveness and really reducing companies' flexibility to change and adapt, you know, particularly as they face more global competition.
Are you talking about entitlements here, such as penalties, overtime, leave loadings?
I think we do have to say, you know, things like penalty rates, were they things that certainly applied many years ago, but something like retail or hospitality, which is now a 24/7 industry, are those things appropriate in the modern day? Who is winning and losing from that? How many small businesses are having to employ their kids on a Sunday because they can't pay the penalty rates? How many people are not opening that shop because they think, well, you know, I can't afford that? Let's be at least willing to have the conversation.
Would you like to see enterprise agreements that have been signed off between employers and unions put up for renegotiation?
That's something that individual organisations will, you know, make their own decisions about. But obviously they have an expiring term, and then that's when they're renegotiated. But we have to be able to create a system where companies can adapt to rapid change. And, you know, that is something that will allow us to stay more competitive.
But did you see, for example, entitlements that were within agreements in the case of SPC Ardmona or Toyota as being critical to survival or long-term employment?
Clearly, some of the conditions that we've heard about in the public discussion about those two cases, you know, in anyone's common sense, are excessive and unsustainable.
Business Council of Australia Chief Executive Jennifer Westacott speaking with our business editor Peter Ryan. And still on business, Qantas is refusing to comment on speculation that it will announce 5,000 job cuts when it releases its half-year results on Thursday. The latest number, if correct, overshadows an additional 1,000 job cuts flagged by Qantas in December. The struggling airline is under pressure to restructure its finances as it seeks a debt guarantee from the federal government. The business editor Peter Ryan is with me in the studio. And what is Qantas saying about the latest reports on how many jobs will go?
Well, good morning, Chris. Qantas says the 5,000 figure reported in News Limited tabloids, quoting an unnamed Qantas source, is, quote, speculation, and the airline is not in a position to play a numbers game, especially a few days out from a major results announcement. But a Qantas spokesman told me this morning there has been a lot of speculation, with the rumoured job cuts bouncing around in recent days from 2,000 to 3,000 up to 6,000 and recently a very specific 2,670. Now, Qantas maintains this unsourced speculation is, quote, unsubstantiated and, of course, unsourced. But, of course, while this is all about focusing on the numbers, it's worth remembering the very big human factor here, with the talk obviously unsettling for Qantas staff potentially in the frame to lose their jobs.
So what do we know and what might be in store for Qantas, and how deep could the cuts be?
Well, Qantas issued its profit warning last December and said more than 1,000 additional jobs will be going over the next 12 months. This is part of the airline's cost-cutting strategy as Alan Joyce looks to save around $2 billion over 3 years. Qantas says that everything is on the table, but more recently I've been told that terminal leases in Melbourne, Perth and Brisbane could be renegotiated, saving tens of millions of dollars. But Qantas has been quick to correct a number of rumours circulating and says it will not be dropping routes from Dubai to London or to Johannesburg.
Well, how closely will the Prime Minister and Treasury be watching what Qantas says on Thursday?
Well, Qantas appears to be edging closer to getting the debt guarantee from the federal government, effectively borrowing the government's sovereign debt rating to raise money on global markets. The language on the debt deal has changed over the last week or so. Treasurer Joe Hockey will, of course, be watching to see whether Qantas is able to get its house in order. But Qantas says it will press ahead with the cost reductions, regardless of whether the federal government decides to act.
Business editor Peter Ryan, thank you. And briefly in finance, the Australian dollar is higher this morning at 90.46 US cents. And in New York, the Dow Jones is trading at 16,255 points. That's up 152 points. I'm Chris Yulman. That is AM for today.